On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talked to Patrick Adams about the intimate apparel industry, Victoria's Secret, and more. We also talked to Brendan Gann about how to use YouTube from big brands to small business. Stay tuned. That's up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, the intersection of marketing and the internet, where we talk about everything that's happening on the web. How brands are using the internet, how we're using YouTube, social media, and much more. Today, we're going to talk about the undergarment, underapparel industry, and how that's growing, moving from the brick and mortar into the online space at a rapid pace, and the market's being flooded with bras and panties, but selling quite well. We're also going to talk about YouTube and viral videos. The mystery of how to make a viral video is still unknown, but we do know what's working, and we know that brands and agencies are spending a lot more money in the space. We've got two guests joining us today, certainly an expert in the undergarment, under apparel industry, and that is Patrick Adams. He's the former head of marketing for Victoria's Secret, and he is on the board for Adore Me. Welcome, Patrick, to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We've also got Brendan Gone. He is a YouTube consultant and has built a strong career in advising brands on how to use YouTube to go viral. You work with clients like Pepsi and Bud Light and Sonos and many, many more. If you look Brandon up on Wikipedia, there's a long list of people there. Welcome both. Welcome, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I know you guys were really excited that we were going to talk about the undergarment industry and women's underwear. You both were like, Tanya, please have me on the show. What, you know, please. You know, there's this huge list of people that wanted to come on, right?
Absolutely. If it's about panties, I want to be there. That's what I said. Right.
Anthony, I can barely see you, but you're blushing. All right. So, Patrick, I've known you for a while, mostly through social media. You were with Victoria's Secret for about 5 years. You're now with Adore Me, which is an internet-based women's apparel outlet, and they've been doing quite well. You know, Victoria's Secret is such an iconic brand, and there's so many now that have popped up in the space that Victoria's Secret really dominated for such a long time. I mean, you certainly had brands that made Wacall and many others that actually make really fine women's undergarments, but now the internet space is flooded, I think, with women's undergarments, but doing so well. I mean, it's a huge market. We're at $70 billion, I think. It's projected, I think,
worldwide.
Worldwide for 2015. And, you know, I guess, so let's step back. You know, so you were Victoria's Secret, like I said, for 5 years. And I've been a Victoria's Secret customer myself, but now there are so many other options. What have you seen in the 5 years that since you started to today from the standpoint of the growth of the market?
I mean, the market has really just exploded. You know, first and foremost, I have to say that working for a brand like Victoria's Secret was just awesome for someone like me. Seeing and working with a well-built brand was an absolute pleasure. And the customer base itself was really just spectacular. But at the same time, the transition in the marketplace over even my last 5 years within the lingerie business has been completely game-changing, mostly because, honestly, when I entered the business, a big design house like Victoria's Secret around lingerie would tell customers what they wanted, what they needed, what color palette made sense for them. And then over the last 5 years, the customer really has gotten into the conversation by telling the designers what they like, what they don't like, what fits, what doesn't fit. And so it's really become a customer-driven industry and business for sure.
So, okay, we've seen, you know, that's a lot of money in that industry. And, you know, as a consumer, I think, wow, there's so many great options. And I love the idea that I don't have to go into a brick and mortar store, because I can remember, you know, you and I were talking about this offline, like Mall of America, there's like five or 10, I don't know, different Victoria's Secret stores. And you'd always have like these big bins full of bras and panties. And it's just like this, you know, shopping galore. That was the way that we shopped then. The way that we shop now is we actually don't fill our actual basket up. We fill our virtual basket up, our shopping basket, and then we go back and buy. What are you seeing as a differentiator, though? Because, again, back in the day, if I didn't go to Bloomingdale's or Dillard's or something to buy my underwear, I went to Victoria's Secret, right? So, but now with so many other competitors, how are brands differentiating themselves online to get customers to engage with their product and their business?
It's honestly really knowing your customer as best you possibly can. I think the brand that caters to customer need, what they're looking for, what's important to them, is a brand that's breaking through. It all starts with a very well built, strategically built brand, which Victoria's Secret absolutely has. But you can't just live on brand alone. You really have to be able to cater to customers' needs, whether it be about fit or variety or size or access or value. You really need to understand what's most important to your very best customers, and you better give it to them.
The conversation around listening to your consumers is so important. I think whether you're male or female, whether you're 83 or 23, you really want to know that the business that you give your money to is actually listening to you. And social media allows us to do that today.
Yeah.
How do you see the apparel industry, specifically the undergarment industry, the bras and panties out there? How do you see those businesses changing to listen to something that really a lot of women are kind of embarrassed to talk about? Maybe they don't want to share it. Maybe they're excited about it. Maybe they want to flaunt it. But it's still a very controversial kind of conversation. How do you have that conversation over social media?
Yeah, I mean, it's still a pretty private conversation that women aren't having kind of really so much out in the open, but they're having it in more closed communities. So social allows you to create a scalable closed community where you can listen to women who have concerns or issues or challenges and really do something about it. It allows you to get in surgically when you have to create panels. It allows you to talk to big groups of individuals when you need to. It really gives you endless flexibility. Everything from I've sat side by side with a brand buyer, and I've sat in big audiences with brand buyers. It really depends on what you're trying to get at, but technology and social specifically gives you the flexibility to do it any number of ways. Topic drives how you would do it, you know, how personal the topic is.
So, Patrick, there are so many people out there that are even building an individual brands. Brandon, you have a strong reputation of understanding how to focus on building brands and on YouTube and, you know, viral videos and that sort of thing. A YouTube star, in fact, YouTube has a whole new campaign that they've just launched to really focus on YouTube celebrities and show that, you know, that YouTubers can actually create their own brand. Bethany Metoya is one of those that has created a huge following. I think they're saying she's making somewhere around maybe, I don't know, 40,000 a month in you know, her YouTube views. What would you say about the intimacy that she shares and basically the personal user and what they're sharing and on social media and YouTube?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think there are a lot of parallels to kind of what we're talking about around the success of the YouTubers. And even what Patrick was talking about with Adore Me, I think the content creators and the brands that are generating a lot of traction are the ones that it's not about, you know, ultra produced content, but more about incorporating the community and the guys that understand the mechanics of the platform as well as how to create really create a community and interact with the consumers or viewers in a way where they feel like they're a part of the content. Those are the people that really generate the most traction. And it's very different than, a lot of the traditional media. And I think a great kind of example that I'm seeing is, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, there was the, YouTube gave $100 million in investment money to allow for premium content creators to kind of develop content for the platform. And a lot of the people that got that money were more traditional media houses and production companies and stuff. And they didn't really generate a lot of traction. And now what YouTube has done is kind of shifted their focus, and they're with their Google Preferred campaign, they're highlighting folks like Bethany and Michelle Phan, and putting them on billboards and raising awareness around them, because those that really understand the nuances of the platform are the ones that are generating traction and continuing to grow. If you don't understand how to, you know, create that dialogue, it just doesn't convert. It's got to be, you know, one-to-one versus just like a pipe, you know, you yelling out to this closed audience, this captured audience, like on TV.
Bethany started when she was in high school. In fact, her story is kind of interesting because she actually was homeschooled because she was being bullied at school. She had cyberbullying that was happening to her. And so she used YouTube to kind of express herself and create her own brand. She's now got her own clothing line with Apostle. I think it's Apostle. And she's just, you know, launched a career. You know, we're talking about targeting millennials, I think, you know, although Patrick would probably say that we're also certainly in the underwear garment industry, we're also targeting our grandmas. But I think, you know, many of us are trying to figure out how to engage that millennial audience. I mean, what is somebody like Bethany doing to actually pull in the kind of viewers that's getting her a personal brand?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think there's like a single way to encapsulate like what it is that they're doing. But ultimately, it's I think it's being human and approachable. I think a lot of the YouTubers, I imagine that a lot of their appeal is the fact that it seems approachable. While they have millions of followers, and I mean, and many of them are getting, you know, cable TV numbers online, there's still a level of approachability that, hey, they're just like me. And that really resonates with the younger audience in particular. And YouTube is much bigger for millennials than any other age group. So I think the approachability is a big part of it. And the ability of a lot of the top creators to kind of appear as if they're on the same level and actually stay on the same level versus kind of like what I was referring to earlier with TV. It seems like there's this separation between you and the content. You know, it's I'm pushing the content out. There's no kind of feedback loop. And on YouTube, there's that feedback loop. You feel like you're a part of it.
Okay. Brands are moving to the internet, brands and agencies. We talked about that when we started the show, and they feel like, I think they can be a little more edgy. They can say things. We saw that with Kmart. I mean, Kmart came out with what I thought was some pretty funny advertising towards the end of last year. They came out with, let's watch.
Sounds like you could use some big ass savings.
I'd love some big ass savings.
Kmart Shop Your Way members save 30 cents a gallon.
30 cents a gallon? That's a big ass discount.
Big ass discount.
A really big ass discount.
Really big ass discount.
Honey, this solves your big ass problem.
Totally solves my big ass problem.
Dad, look at that big ass truck.
Big ass man.
Hello, big ass man.
Shop Your Way members get big ass savings. Save 30 cents a gallon when you spend $50 or more at Kmart.
Okay. Obviously, when they came out with that, I think that was really pushing the limit for the Kmart brand. But it was really funny. And I think probably everyone I know shared it because it was interesting. I mean, when you talk about how much money it costs to buy time, I mean, I think that's targeting, I think, just about anybody, but certainly maybe a more millennial, edgy environment. If you look at, so buying a 30-second spot on The Big Bang Theory, which is a really popular show, especially with millennials, is $360,000, right? So that's 30 seconds. You can go viral for much less and get a lot more eyeballs. I mean, I think this video, I'm trying to remember how many actually it got, but it was huge. It went incredibly viral on the internet. What do you say about that from the standpoint of the money that we're spending and the types of content we're creating, Brendan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. The media dollars, no doubt about it. I mean, you can get a lot more bang for your buck in YouTube and digital as a whole. I mean, I think YouTube is a micro kind of example of a macro trend. But I mean, you can generate a lot of earned media, which is obviously great because not only are you getting the eyeballs, but probably more important, you're actually getting people who care about the content and are engaging with it, which means they're more inclined to, I mean, assuming they like it, go and share it and go buy it. But I think also what's really interesting is beyond just buying TV and getting viral videos, you can actually buy a lot of targeted media on YouTube as well. And I think a lot of brands are underutilizing that component as well. I mean, there's a huge, the level of targeting you can get, you know, on a cost per view basis for that versus, you know, TV, it doesn't even pale in comparison. You're getting a way better discount or way better deal. So I'm not sure kind of why so many brands are still spending the kind of dollars on TV if it's not kind of generating that earned awareness and it's not as targeted. It seems like more and more it's becoming irrelevant, and YouTube is really a really key component in marketing.
But, you know, I would say, and I would think if you talk to most brands and agencies, they would tell you that it isn't just about creating a video online. You still see Kmart spending a lot of other, it's strategy, right? It takes traditional public relations. It takes a lot of other types of advertising. Patrick, I think this is a good question for you. You focus mostly on e-commerce at Victoria's Secret. And I think it is multi-tactic campaigns. Yeah, I mean, these videos are great and they're funny and we're all sharing them on Facebook or tweeting them out on Twitter or whatever. But it isn't just that one tactic that's actually going to bring the final sale, right? The end of shopping cart.
Right, absolutely. And I was thinking about that as you guys were talking. It's all about, for me, balance and strategy. And so you look at your toolkit, and in a lot of ways, what drives the greatest level of interaction, interactivity, and profitability would be a TV commercial and possibly a catalog and possibly an email and possibly some paid search. And so I think you look at it at its entirety and you plan the cycle or the season or the event appropriately. I don't believe in the black and white, you know, move, you know, from one extreme to the other. I think that there's balance and you look to see what mixture of media is going to drive the greatest level of productivity for you and your brand.
Okay, let's just face it. If I post a picture on my Facebook page of a Victoria's Secret model walking down the runway, I get lots of likes. We like looking at pictures. It's happened. I'm like, wow, that's really popular. I should post more of that. But the type of product that you're selling makes a really big difference on the ultimate sale too. And I think specifically when you think about the undergarments, right? The bras, the panties, especially like bras, right? So like we want to make sure they fit correctly. And that's a really difficult thing to, you know, I mean, I don't know how many of you guys out there have experienced this, but certainly from a female perspective, this is something that you have to make sure fits. How do you bring that personal experience of actually touching the garment, feeling the garment, wearing the garment to the internet sale and make it successful?
It really depends on the customer and what their level of comfort is. Some customers exclusively want to go in store, have a face-to-face conversation, and be fit in person. Some customers are actually very, very fine with the tools that are available online, whether it be on a desktop or a mobile application, to help you find the best fit for you. And so, again, it goes back to the customer and what they're comfortable with. And then some customers do a mixture of things. They might try on one or two things in store and then experiment online with having a handful of bras shipped to them that they can try on. Whatever fits, they keep. Whatever they don't like, they return. And so it really, really depends, again, on the customer and her level of comfort. But you do need to give her a variety of ways in which to do it that makes sense for her. No cookie cutter here, really. It depends on the customer.
How have you seen the industry, specifically over the last 5 years that you were with Victoria's Secret? We talked about the brick and mortar store, people going into the store versus e-commerce. How much did that change in the industry as a whole? Maybe not just with Victoria's Secret, but certainly in the under apparel portion of the industry.
Right. Significant. I think Victoria's Secret, like many other brands, probably 5 years ago, online sales are 40-50% of overall direct business. And I think it's probably like 90%+ of the direct business these days. And so game changing, no two ways about it. And then mobile becoming very popular in the last couple of years is really taking the lion's share of that activity, that digital activity. And so it continues to change as technology advances and as customer behavior changes as well.
Victoria's Secret was known for the supermodels wearing the lingerie down the runway and have very branded towards this kind of supermodel feel, right? Mm-hmm. But Adore Me, which is the brand that you're focusing on right now, is, you know, it's all about the personal experience. You even have people who have like their brand representatives. They're actually customers that are wearing the product. I mean, that's a big change, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, it's one of the things that really excited me about working with Adore Me. When you find a company that is super passionate about the customer and says things like, you know, we believe beauty comes in all shapes, all sizes, all ages, all ethnicities, how could you not be excited about that core promise or that core principle? To me, that speaks exactly into the sweet spot of millennials, but really is something that makes you proud of what you do day in and day out. And so it's very much about their DNA. It's very much about an inclusive brand versus an exclusive brand. You don't have to be a supermodel or look like a supermodel, because that isn't the only form of beauty. You could be who you are and still be absolutely gorgeous. And a company like Adore Me will help you do that. And so, I think it's a big change, but a refreshing one for me, and one that I really feel passionate about.
You're seeing this movement again. I mentioned women's apparel, or specifically women's undergarments, really being popular, and all these, you know, True Company, Adore Me, and even Victoria's Secret going much more e-commerce focused. But you're also seeing, you know, all the different shaving, you know, websites to get shaving. I mean, so it's really this personal experience online. Yep. And a lot of these companies are using viral videos. I think Dollar Shave Club is one that comes to mind as one of my favorites. And I still think that's a funny video. So, Brendan, how important is the brand creating something funny or engaging? I mean, is that the target, or is it more about the message of the product? What's the message that brands should focus on for their viral, hopefully viral video?
Well, I think in terms of creating content that's shareable, it's funny. I was actually just reading up a bunch of studies about this, and the stuff that generates the most traction is what's been called like high arousal content. So the stuff that it's not just going to make you smile or smirk or chuckle a little bit, but like is really going to make you laugh out loud, or the inverse of that. You know, you get really angry. Obviously, a lot of brands don't want to do that with consumers, but ultimately, it's something that's going to generate like a real physiological reaction. And I think what's really interesting is, while that is what's shareable, and I think innately everybody kind of knows that, brands have a tough time getting out of their own way and speaking to people in a way that feels real like that. And you almost need to understand and approach it from not what is the message I need to get out first and foremost, but what is actually going to generate some mind share with people. And I think an example of a company that does this really, really well is GoPro. I know we were talking about this a bit yesterday, but obviously they're creating great content, and to a certain extent, they've got a lot of things in their favor. I mean, they're essentially a content company. But the stuff that they've that they empower people to create is really awe-inspiring. And a lot of people are watching that, and they're actually like, you know, you gasp when somebody's, you know, jumping out of a plane and they've got a GoPro on their head. So they've done a great job on the content side. And then they've also got the distribution down. They understand really how to cultivate a community on the platform. They've implemented every, you know, YouTube best practice known to man. And they've managed to cultivate a community. And actually, the majority of their content comes from users who are evangelizing their product. So they've done a good job with both the content and the distribution components.
And you know, it's kind of it relates to this experience of the brand gets me. They know what I want to be. They know how I want to feel, kind of like Adormies, you know, using consumers to, you know, show off their product. I think GoPro does a great job. In fact, I'm a big fan, and our CEO, Lisa, is wanting me to get them on Maverick. So if you're out there, GoPro, I need to get you on the show. But they do a great
Hey, Tanya, just one thing I just wanted to add on to that. I think it's also very important that you really understand your brand and your brand promise while you're dabbling in, whether it be video or apps or whatever the case may be, because sometimes the brand doesn't really warrant a certain type of video or a certain level of technology. You know, last year we saw brands introducing 3, 4, 5 different types of apps because they felt as though they had to, because everyone else was doing it. And I would just caution to say that, you know, when you heavily lean into a YouTube or an app or whatever the case may be, make sure that it's really synergistic with your brand promise, and your brand personality to get the most out of it. Just because someone else is doing it doesn't mean you have to or you should.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, you and I have had this conversation about mobile and the app space, and not every, you know, your background before you got into women's undergarments was in the banking industry, and you worked for a variety of different banks. And I think that makes sense for a mobile app, but that doesn't make sense necessarily for bras and panties, because, you know, I'm not out. Oh, wait, I should order underwear, you know. Yeah. So I think we have to look at all the channels we're using, and viral videos aren't necessarily meant for every brand either. Yeah. But OK, so GoPro does a great job of, I think, making us feel like who we want to be. I always say Pinterest is, I love Pinterest. Pinterest is the person we aspire to be. And I think GoPro does a really good job of implementing that in their product. And what their story is really interesting too, because they literally got started at selling, I think, seashells on the seashore kind of thing. They got started with nothing. They raised money for GoPro, and they've been hugely successful in kind of the organic startup space. Who else do you think, Brandon, is doing a good job in the space?
Well, you know, I think the people that actually are probably most impressive and are going to be overtaking a lot of the more traditional brands out there are actually the brands created by the creators. I know we referenced what Bethany is doing. But there are a number of creators who are really using these audiences and fan bases that they've cultivated to then parlay that to promote some other passion of theirs or business. And, you know, a great example of this is guys like Charles Strippy, who's in the band We the Kings. He used his YouTube audience to basically propel his band We the Kings' latest album to the top of the iTunes charts. And, you know, they actually knocked out Beyonce from the number one spot 2 days after her latest album dropped. So there's like clearly a lot of value in these audiences, and these YouTubers are recognizing that, and they're figuring out lots of different ways to tap into that audience and point it to different businesses and passions. And, you know, I know Michelle Phan, who's the number one makeup video blogger, she launched a company, subscription service company, that's doing really well. They raised a round of funding. And a lot of these YouTubers have fairly large merch businesses, and, you know, they're creating, you know, movies and TV shows. So I think that's probably what's most exciting. These guys understand how to leverage and communicate with audiences within this ecosystem in a way that a lot of more traditional marketers don't understand.
But, you know, I also think it would be a bit of an understatement to say that not everyone gets celebrity status on YouTube. And
yeah, that's true.
There, I think it's the percentage is very small, but, you know, everyone aspires, you know, I'm going to have this great, you know, channel, and people are just going to start liking my stuff, and I'm going to be really popular. I think what Bethany did was get started very early on, and she's so young that she really related to young girls, and she did a phenomenal job of that. So what's the secret sauce for somebody that wants to get on YouTube and, you know, make $40,000 a month and get their own clothing line and all of that kind of stuff?
If I knew that answer, I'd probably be doing a channel.
Exactly.
No, I mean, I think it's really, you know, it's marketing. It's identifying a niche, somewhere where you can add value that, you know, somebody's not addressing, and ideally something that you're passionate about. And I think that's what all these creators have done. They've pursued their passions. Luckily, there wasn't, you know, already an established audience out there. There are plenty of other people with the same passions, and they cultivated a following. But I think across the board, the people that have been really successful are people that just come across as human, and they're not approaching it from a sales first kind of standpoint. It's their passion first, and then it becomes a job. And I think that that differentiation is really key, because I think while it's a little bit intangible, when you are really excited about something, that resonates with people.
Patrick, you and I have had conversations about beyond the millennials. I mean, I think, you know, brands like GoPro, I think, target a little bit more of the millennials or maybe the adventure side of some of the other age groups. But so I'm going to go back to, I remember I was interviewing an internet-based, we'll just say GoDaddy, and they had a big campaign, whether you liked it or not, about GoDaddy girls. And I remember my mom and my aunt and my grandmother were listening to the show. And even my grandmother, who's in her 90s, hi, Grandma, was wanting to be a GoDaddy girl. So I think we all aspire to have this kind of fresh, you know, millennial feel to our lives. So how does the apparel industry approach that? Because I think Adore Me is starting to approach on that. You've got a young daughter yourself, and she's certainly impressionable. What message are now businesses and brands starting to pick up on as far as engaging a broader audience?
Right. Yeah, I think it goes back to healthy body image, inclusivity. There are many different types of beauty. I think old school, old retail was picture perfect runway model, and that was what you aspired to look like and aspired to be. I think today, especially the millennials, reject that. When you see the reaction to all the photoshopping that's going on and the touching up of imagery, people just don't want that anymore. They don't want to be fooled into what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. And so I think it's about honesty. I think it's about authenticity. I think it's about all of those things and making sure it flows through, not just in your brand promise, but in who you choose to model your apparel and the way in which you merchandise your apparel and the stories you tell as you're trying to engage a customer. It needs to be real. It needs to be honest. It needs to be authentic. It needs to be very, very low retouched because that's just not honest. And so I think it's about all of those things to really cut through today.
And it seems like heritage brands, and certainly Victoria's Secret is one of them, but there's a lot of other heritage brands out there that have this, I think, attitude. And I'm not saying that Victoria's Secret does, but there certainly are a lot of heritage brands that feel like, hey, this is how we've always done it. This is what we're going to do moving forward. And you see startups like Adore Me or True Company or others, you know, that are trying to come up with a more personal feel. They're trying to engage consumers in a different way. What would your message be to the heritage brands who do see, you know, like you said, 90% of their business moving to internet-based content? So they're competing now at a much more equal platform to these other startups. What do they need to do different?
I honestly, it's about not fighting the trend because it's done. It's embracing it and it's going with it. And I hate to keep on saying the same thing, but I think technology is a great facilitator for getting to really know your customer and understanding customer intimacy. And it's about doing all of those things, because the minute you nail how the customer wants to experience you, where he or she wants to experience you, it permeates everything you do. And the bigger brands, the more established brands, are having a tougher time doing it because they've had success in the past with the way in which they've done things. It's kind of like a broadcast approach to engaging or interacting. I hate to even call it interacting, but engaging with the customer. And the newer brands, the startups, they don't really have that baggage to deal with. They get to start fresh and new as an authentic consumer-based organization, and that's what the consumer wants and needs and demands today.
You know, startups, certainly they can get funding, and there's programs out there like Kickstarter and many more that can help them, or they can go to a VC, or maybe they just go to friends and family and raise money. Yep. But they still don't have the deep pockets that a company the size of like a Victoria's Secret or many other types of brands have to use the internet to, you know, whether it's contextual targeting or other types of you know, internet-based, you talked about email campaigns. I mean, so how does a small business, a startup in this space compete against the big heritage brand?
You don't out the gate, but you compartmentalize and you prioritize. So, for example, a brand new startup, their focus and their activity is going to be about establishing their brand. So all their activity is about the brand. And about building what the brand means. And there are so many actually inexpensive ways to do it digitally versus old school, the way it was done back in the day. And so you start, in a way, piecemeal. You kind of build the business as you go along, but you really have to pick off the bits and pieces that are the most meaningful, most impactful, and just kind of layer it as you go and as you build a customer base that has a tremendous amount of recency.
So I've been influenced. I'm going to admit that I've been influenced not just by GoPro, and I put things on my Pinterest page of the person that I aspire to be. You know, I have two snowboards, and I attribute some of that to Red Bull, which is really good in the viral video space. They've done some really great jobs. Brandon, you've actually talked about Red Bull. What is it that Red Bull has figured out that some of the other brands haven't?
Well, yeah, I think... kind of going back to what I was talking about earlier, they understand how to tap into people's passions. And, you know, they've actually, there's this larger trend that a lot of brands are trying to be media companies. And Red Bull is probably the only one that I can think of that's actually legitimately pulled that off. They focus first and foremost on creating great content and distributing it in a way that people will actually want to interact with it and share with it. And luckily for them, kind of going back to what Patrick was saying earlier, like, you've got to make sure that there's an alignment with the platform you're using and making sure it actually is relevant to your brand. Luckily, you know, Red Bull's whole brand platform is Red Bull Gives You Wings. And as a result, you know, them being involved in extreme sports and people jumping out of airplanes and all this awesome content that people really actually enjoy looking at, it makes great video. And it represents their brand in a really relevant way.
You know, I want to interject that one of the things that I think that we talked about earlier that's so important that is that it's not just creating great content, and great content certainly depends on what your audience thinks is great content. So it's what the viewers are thinking, it's what they're liking, but they also do a really strong grassroots movement to their campaign. I mean, you see them if you go, coming from Colorado, especially in the mountain towns, they're at, you know, these, you know, whether it's skateboarding or snowboarding or, you know, dirt biking. I mean, you see Red Bull branded at these events. And I think GoPro probably has done the same thing. I think they're kind of similar from the standpoint of understanding even the Mountain Dew, I think, did that at some point. They really understood they needed to be where their consumers were. So it wasn't just being on the internet. But again, it goes back to but that costs money, right? And creating really good content, hiring an agency, it costs money. I mean, how you know, YouTube, Brandon. I mean, how can a small person, a small business, use YouTube as a platform? How can they understand the nuances of the platform? Maybe they don't have the kind of money to make really great, you know, high quality digital videos, but they want to use YouTube. So how can they do that on a kind of a low budget?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I think in a lot of ways that approaching YouTube from, a big brand standpoint in a lot of ways can be a disadvantage, because then you tend to skew for more like go more the commercial route, highly produced. And that actually tends to not really work that well most of the time. I think actually speaking to people as humans on a real personal level is what resonates the most. And you know, we're talking about the brands that are successful on YouTube, but it's also, if you look at it compared to Facebook and Twitter, the top, you know, 50 or so profiles on Facebook and Twitter, they're filled up with brands who have essentially bought their way there. On YouTube, it's much harder to buy your way. You can't buy subscribers. There's no media platform for that. So the majority of people really got there through hard work. And it's primarily, organic grassroots content creators who are doing little more than, webcam videos oftentimes. So it's less about what I can produce, but more how I can create an emotional connection. And parallel to that, though, YouTube provides a lot of resources. There are a ton of free resources. I'm totally going to sound like a salesman for YouTube, but you know, they've got production spaces in LA. They're creating one in New York. They've got a whole YouTube creator playbook and brand playbook that basically lays out, this is exactly what you need to do, and this is how you do it to, optimize your content for the platform and make the most out of it. So there's a lot of inexpensive resources out there actually are successful.
What are brands like Pepsi, and you work with Pepsi, you work with Budweiser, yep, big budgets, big dollars, yeah, they can spend to try to create something that people will like and want to share on social media. What is it that they're focusing on as far as creating a viral campaign?
Totally. In terms of viral, Pepsi's had a string of hits, and I haven't worked on any of these, but I wish I had. They're pretty funny. If you look up, there's Test Drive and Test Drive 2. They did a series of videos with Jeff Gordon, who's a NASCAR driver, and they had him dress up in disguise, and in the most recent one, he basically was in a cab and he picked up this blogger from Jalopnik, which is a big car blog. And he was in disguise as a kind of like an ex-con taxi driver who wouldn't pull over when a cop car was trying to pull him off to the side of the road. So the guy in the back of the cab is freaking out. He has no idea what's going on. And it was hilarious. And skip ahead a little bit. Ultimately, pranks are doing really well. That's definitely a great go-to. And actually, Bud Light basically did a big prank for their their Super Bowl campaign. They up for whatever. They took a guy out all over the town, and you know, one minute he'd walk into a room and be playing ping pong with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the next he's getting into an elevator with a goat. And So pranks are doing really well, and I think part of that goes back to kind of the emotional connection. Pranks are a little bit safer for brands. It's funny, but it's also getting a response from people. People are laughing, along with it, and that's tapping into that kind of like those emotions that are critical in driving sharing.
How important is comedy? And that you make a good point. I think I remember both of those campaigns. I thought they were really funny. How important is comedy? I mean, are we seeing more of a cinematic approach that works, or is it the funny prankster approach that's working?
I think it can be either, so long as it's actually funny. There was actually a study done in this book I was just reading, The Science of Sharing. And this woman, a professor in Australia, I think, analyzed something like 350 billion streams of online video. And the most shared type of content and the emotion that was most shared was content that was hilarity, funny content. So I think so long as you're tapping into that emotion, however you bring that to life is ultimately what's going to generate traction. But a lot of marketers struggle with that. They think something's funny and it's really just a little bit out of touch.
Out of touch. You know, I think sometimes I think I'm funny, and I'm not sure Anthony would agree that maybe I'm not as funny as I think I am, but I do think that comedy is a big part of it. But I also think it's this kind of reality feel, because you're talking about, organic content. You're talking about the things that even big brands are trying to make things look more reality, right? They're trying to make it look like a prankster. I mean, everybody wants to have this very reality feel, which again goes back to this idea of sharing the kinds of content that we want online, like Adore Me has done. Okay, so how do you know, Patrick, that something like this is going to work in the apparel market? I mean, you're doing it, but what kind of data are you using to say, yep, we get it, you guys want us to be more aware of what you want, and so we're doing it. I mean, are you already seeing sales? I mean, how are you competing based on that mentality?
That's exactly the point that I was going to just bring up, because one of the things I think that's really critical in this conversation is what are your success measures? And so if it's just about driving traffic or engagement, it's one thing and you can kind of measure that. But ultimately, when you're driving and managing a business, you're trying to drive profitability, trying to drive sales or sales through the funnel. And so for me, you really have to be very specific about what the end game is. And so when you say a video was successful, or it's interesting because the video that Brendan just mentioned, I loved and shared with my sons for weeks, but I couldn't tell you who the brand was. I remember the video and I remember exactly what happened, the phase one and the phase two, and the guy came back and he didn't believe it. All of that, it was awesome. But I couldn't remember who actually sponsored it. And so then in my mind, if I were the brand owner, I would be kind of upset about that, because there wasn't enough about the video that resonated with me who sponsored it, who did it, who was behind it. And so I think it's critical that when you create these events and these situations, that it still supports the brand and still supports productivity, and it's not just for the sake of doing it. But to get to your point, Tanya, it's absolutely about ultimately looking at the level of activity you're driving to the .com or the mobile site, and it's ultimately how many customers are you converting profitably. If it isn't about that, or building a brand, or both, I'm not sure why you're doing it.
How important is social responsibility, Patrick, to the brand, whether it's a big brand that certainly has the money to back up being very socially responsible, or even a small brand? I mean, even as a business leader, as the head of marketing for such a big brand, how is social responsibility play in?
I think it's very, very important, especially when you talk about this kind of new generation, the millennials coming up. It's one of the things that's extremely important to them. It's extremely important to me just personally. I think it is a key factor in establishing a significant brand in today's environment. Absolutely no two ways about it. I also believe that the way in which a brand treats their customers and a way in which a brand treats their associates is also very important too. And I think it's also overlooked as a key attribute to brand success.
Abercrombie & Fitch has been touted for not being very liked because they're very discriminatory about who they want seen wearing their products. Right. And they've gotten a lot of backlash in the media about it. And we definitely have seen sales decline for them. I mean, but is that just an isolated case, or brands that maybe are? And I would say if you have a product and you want a certain type of person to buy your product, I don't necessarily think in general that that's a bad thing, except you don't. I also think that you have to be considerate of you know, the kind of message you're putting out there, and you have to be able to accept that not everybody's going to like that. So right. are we really going to see people stop buying products because somebody is not socially aware with their brand?
I think there are many factors affecting big brands today. I think it will be one of them. And it really depends on how well the brand does in other arenas. But again, if you think about the millennials, and we're all kind of chasing after the millennials and the millennials' eyeballs, I think it's specifically meaningful to that group of individuals. And you will see individuals turned off if they feel as though a brand is not socially responsible or aware within the environment, whether it be, whether the brand is green, or, you know, how they're treating their employees, or, you know, how exclusive versus inclusive they are. All of those things, I think, specifically is very meaningful to the millennials.
You know, Brandon, I know you don't work for YouTube, so you can't really speak to the internal operations of the organization. But having worked with them, and, you know, certainly if anybody Googles you or looks up your Wikipedia, you've got a long history of being successful with the platform. How does YouTube make sure that the content out there is, maybe, you know, if it's not socially responsible, certainly isn't offensive? I mean, is that something they care about?
I can't speak to their exact process necessarily, but I know they've got some sort of filtering in place. That said, there is a lot of outreach that they do with both brands and creators to help kind of guide them down the path of what's appropriate. But in terms of censorship, I don't think they typically get involved unless something's, you know, pretty terrible, to be honest.
Pretty terrible. That's open-ended. Who would decide what pretty terrible is, right? Okay. So YouTube is a good place. There's a lot of other social platforms out there. You've been on the marketing side, the agency side of the business, Brandon, for a while. I know you're headed to the Next Web to talk about viral videos and how important they are. But again, we don't completely understand, although we think comedy is important and some sort of reality concept is important. What are you going to say at the Next Web, and what's your big message you want to get across?
Yeah, totally. Without giving the whole talk away.
No, give it away right now. Yeah. We are all going to be there, right?
I think it might be live streamed, actually. really what I'm going to be talking about is kind of like, I'm trying to distill it into three sections, really. I mean, one, content's important. It's really critical, but content to a certain extent is being commoditized. And so, you've got to keep in mind that to even have a shot at standing out, you've got to create something that's going to incorporate those high arousal emotions, like those studies I referenced. The second component is really all about incorporating an audience, some sort of a community, and speaking to them very directly. I think oftentimes, in particular in marketing, people tend to say, well, I want to target everybody. But the instant you do that, you're really not talking to anyone. So you've got to speak very directly to your core audience, and get them involved in the campaign, get them invested somehow. I mean, there's a number of ways to do this, whether it's, you provide them some sort of exclusive behind the scenes kind of sneak preview, really give them a reason to care about it that's highly, highly relevant to them. Add some sort of value. And then thirdly, one thing that's really, really interesting is the fact that the perception, the way we kind of view content and kind of the social proof surrounding it plays a big role in whether or not we're even going to view it or share it. It can be the same piece of content, but if it's something that, it's maybe been up for 24 hours, but it's got a bunch of comments and you've seen the bloggers you like and follow talk about it, and there's a bunch of engagement, your odds are you're going to share it. And it really taps into this kind of human psychology where, we tend to kind of follow crowds. And the more you can kind of pull all your levers at once and build in that distribution plan, the more likely you are to then kind of create this self-fulfilling prophecy and kind of driving sharing. Because people see it being shared, they then want to go share it. So that's kind of the 50,000-foot view.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I'm interested in, if there is a live stream, I'm going to watch it, but I'm interested, certainly, we'd love to have you come back. And Patrick, from the standpoint of what you're watching for, I know Omni Channel, which is a, industry term we're hearing a lot lately. We talked about it on our last show with Aaron Strout. Why is that important to you right now?
Because it really boils down to customer experience. I think it's funny about omnichannel. Years ago, everyone was using the buzzword CRM, and CRM meant so many different things. Omnichannel is kind of the same thing. But omnichannel to me means customer experience. It means a connected customer experience for a brand. So regardless of where he or she experiences the brand, it's consistent. Consistent product, consistent pricing, consistent capabilities. It doesn't really make a difference whether she's on the mobile device, she's in the store, she's online. It makes no difference. Her experience is the same and it's holistic. And so I do believe for retail specifically, omnichannel is the focus, and it really has to be the focus. And I think the only way omnichannel can be accomplished is if retailers really and truly make a commitment to understanding the customer holistically, a single view of the customer, using a one view database, understanding where he or she is shopping, what they're buying, how they're buying, and what they want. Those are all the major components to establishing a really healthy omni-channel strategy.
Okay, and as at Adore.me, you're encouraging your customers to post photos of themselves, the products that they like. Are you going to be posting photos of yourself? Because that might be
It depends on if you want it or not. I always respond to customer requests, but I don't think there'll be many coming through for that.
You've got the background. I mean, if you're watching the show, I mean,
I knew you were going to go there.
I gotta set the stage for you. Patrick's got this nice little, like, what is it? A leopard? Is that no? That's zebra skin.
It's a zebra. It's a zebra, is what it is.
Brandon,
and it looks cheesy as I'm looking at it now, but it's really not. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, it definitely looks like you're a player. And Brandon, right. You didn't bring your A game. You're at mom and dad's house.
I had to go home before I fly out, and I'm going to be gone for a few weeks and haven't seen my parents. So yeah, I'm at my parents' house right now.
You know, next time, I think you could take a lesson out of Patrick's playbook and step up your little image there with some, you know, leopard skin in the background, maybe some purple pillows, some satin, you know, something like that.
A big picture of Elvis in velvet, something like that.
Have you guys seen my apartment?
We'll be looking for it on YouTube. I really appreciate you both coming on the show today. I think that I've certainly learned a lot. I think, you know, Patrick, you're certainly somebody to follow it. It's a leader. I think you're really inspiring. I'd love to have you come back. If somebody wants to follow you, Patrick, and learn more about Adore.me or what you're doing, what's the best way they can do that?
Probably Twitter at PAdamsNY. That's probably the best way to contact me and DM me for sure.
Okay. And Brandon, I know you're going to be at the Next Web and traveling abroad. I mean, I saw your passport pictures on Facebook. I have to say, I don't know what you were thinking with the first passport photo, but you've definitely improved. You'll be traveling a lot. So, but if somebody wants to connect with you, maybe follow what you're doing at the Next Web or any of your other adventures, how can they do that?
Yeah, Twitter is probably the best way to get hold of me as well. It's just at Brendan Gahan, BrendanGahan.
And I want to thank both of you for coming and spending some time with me and your busy schedules on the show today. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
That was our episode of Marketing Mavericks, all about YouTube, all about the startup space and women's apparel, everything included. Next week, we've got a great guest coming up. We're going to talk to Evan Green, who's the head of marketing for the Recording Academy, the Grammys, and more. Everybody, thanks again. And that concludes this episode of Marketing Mavericks.